Hello and welcome to Asia Stream, where we track, report, and analyze the issues and interests of the world's largest region. I am Waj Khan, Nikkei Asia's digital editor here in New York City. Today's episode, Iranians versus the Islamic Republic. Who will win? For the past month, Iranians in at least 85 cities across the country have taken to the streets, raising their voices in favor of women's rights and against an Islamist regime they call repressive and corrupt. The demonstrations show no signs of letting up, despite a brutal government crackdown that has led to the deaths of at least 201 people, including children, according to the nonprofit Iran Human Rights. The world is watching intently. Protests of solidarity are popping up across the globe. International celebrities are speaking out in favor of the demonstrators. Many governments are imposing and are contemplating new sanctions against Iranian officials, condemning, in the words of Canada, their blatant disregard for human life. Is the passion and determination of the protesters enough to finally dislodge the Iranian government, the mullahs who have run this country for the past four decades? That's one of the questions we'll be discussing today. You'll hear from a very brave woman demonstrating on the ground. Then Carnegie's Cornelius Adhbar will discuss whether a regime change is, in fact, possible. And finally, the Atlantic Council's Gisunia will walk us through the legalized discrimination system in Iran and what the international community should be doing about it. Grab your picket signs. It's time to march. You're listening to The Sound of Asia, streaming in your ear. From Nikkei Asia, this is Asia Stream.
A reminder that Nikkei Asia is currently offering an exclusive discount for our podcast listeners. Get 3 months of our award-winning coverage for just $9. To redeem, just click the link in the episode description.
So before we bring in our guests, let's get up to speed on what's been going on. Here to help us make sense of it all is Asia Stream correspondent Monica Hunter-Hart. Monica, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you, Wash.
So what are the most crucial things we need to know about where we're at right now with these protests?
Well, we've seen over 200 civilian deaths so far, about 1,700 people arrested, and the government has been severely restricting people's access to the internet, especially to communications apps and platforms like WhatsApp, Signal, Skype, and Instagram.
Right. And does it seem like the regime may actually bend to protester demands?
They've pretty much only signaled that they plan to intensify the crackdown and not pursue reform. But that's not a foregone conclusion, and there have been some possible signs in other directions. The Chief Justice of Iran, who is a hardliner, said on Sunday, citizens or political groups should know that we have an ear for protests and criticism and that we're ready for dialogue.
That's interesting. It seems that there's at least some growing interest in appearing open to reform, but I do wonder how genuine a comment like that is.
Well, same. And that's one reason why I'm so eager to talk to Carnegie Europe's Cornelius Adhbar later. He's an authority on the subject.
Well, now for the 42, 43-year-old question, Monica. What have analysts been saying about the regime? Will there be a regime change?
Well, yeah, that is exactly the question of the hour, and it is a tough one. I'm no expert, but from what I've been following, the takes seem to be shifting a bit this week. So analysts have been giving a little bit more credence to the idea that it is possible that the government could fall. But in general, most do seem to believe that it's a real long shot. Unless we see mass defections from security forces, we've got the armed police and armed Revolutionary Guard against unarmed protesters. A peaceful transition of power is unlikely, and demonstrators don't seem poised to start waging actual war against their government. There's also no real leader to this movement to rally around. And that's one of the many reasons why, even if the regime were to topple, there's no guarantee that what would come next would be any better than what there was before, let alone be democratic. We only need to look to the 1979 Iranian Revolution for the example of that. You know, it brought sweeping changes to Iran, but it also effectively just replaced one corrupt tyrannical regime with another.
Right. And your point brings other examples to mind, too. I mean, if you've learned anything from the Arab Spring, it's that when citizens topple a government, it doesn't always lead to the progress or the version of government they were hoping for. But Monica, you can't just say that these protests aren't going to make an impact, right? I mean, these are the biggest demonstrations in Iran since 2009's Green Movement. These are clearly showing signs that they might be bigger than the green movement.
You're definitely right. They're absolutely going to make an impact. It's just not yet clear exactly what that impact will be. So on this topic, I'll briefly mention some great points being made by Halle Esfandieri of the Wilson Center. One is that if these protests don't result in demonstrators' demands being met, they certainly won't be the last. Protests have been increasing in frequency in Iran in recent years, and people are determined to keep fighting for a better system. And the second is about the age of these protesters, the fact that most of them are in their 20s and 30s. Right. So these are young people who were born after the 1979 revolution. They grew up in a post-revolution Iran. And in some ways, that shows the failure of the Islamic Republic's vision. These are, in many cases, young women who don't know anything else besides those policies, including the compulsory hijab. But that doesn't lessen their outrage about it. The government wasn't able to raise this generation in its own image in the way that it had intended. And frankly, it's too late to fix that.
Right. So it's been a good 4 weeks since these protests began. But for listeners who may not know the origin story, give us a brief overview of how it all started, the tipping point, so to say.
Sure. So on September 13th, a 22-year-old woman named Mahsa Amini was detained in Tehran for wearing a headscarf that was considered too loose. Iran, as we mentioned before, has a mandatory hijab law, and it's been much more strictly enforced since hardliner Ebrahim Raisi took the presidency last year.
Right. And by the way, just so listeners know, the Iranian political system has two broad political components. One is elected, that's headed by Ebrahim Raisi, the president, and one is religious and unelected, headed by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who effectively has had power, well, over everything since 1989.
That's right. So shortly after Mahsa was taken in, she collapsed. She entered a coma and she tragically died. Her death seems to be the result of head trauma after being beaten by the so-called morality police who detained her.
But the government has a different story, right? They say she died of a pre-existing condition, their words. They've been saying that since the beginning. And last weekend, they even came out with a coroner's report that they said substantiates their claims. So they're really effectively doubling down. Meanwhile, Mahsa's family insist that she had no pre-existing condition.
That's right. I mean, the government's story really just doesn't have much credibility here. The fact is that the morality police beat women regularly, and there's a pile of evidence that that is what happened here, including multiple eyewitness accounts, many doctors' assessments, and images leaked to the news outlet Iran International that appear to be CT scans of her skull showing head trauma.
And this isn't the most credible government on the planet, right? I mean, I believe there was a Transparency International study. In fact, in the corruption index, Iran ranks 149 out of 180 countries. Anyways.
No, it's right. And that gets to part of the reason why these protests have picked up so much steam. They are very much about women's rights, including their right to choose whether or not to wear hijab. But people are also protesting the regime's general brutality, corruption, and repression. Watch, this is not a popular government. A June poll conducted by Stasis Consulting in D.C. indicated that President Raisi had a 28% approval rating.
That's almost like President Biden's approval ratings after the gas hikes. But I digress. However, people are angry. And one complaint you're hearing a lot is that the ruling class lives a much, much different life than what regular Iranians do. The ruling elite enact strict laws of social control. And by the way, it's very difficult for everyday people to migrate out of Iran to choose a very different lifestyle. So the people who do get to leave that country are connected to the government closely. Thousands of relatives of senior officials are living outside the country, often in the West, enjoying a much broader set of rights and freedoms. Critics of the regime also point to policies that have stymied the middle class and the economic crisis that's leading to soaring food prices. So it's almost as if there's two Irans, one for the Islamic Republic and those it provides privileges to, and frankly, everybody else.
Yeah, that is the situation. And you can really just feel the frustration pouring out of these protest photos and videos that are circulating on social media.
Also, I must admit, I mean, I'm from the region and this is unprecedented stuff. We've seen women en masse cutting their hair in protest, burning their hijabs around a big bonfire. They're burning photos of the Supreme Leader publicly. They're hacking the state's websites and have pictures of the Ayatollah burning in a ring of fire up. I mean, cases of riot police marching with protesters, classes being suspended at major colleges and universities, workers striking at major oil refineries, potentially threatening an industry that's critical to Iran's faltering economy. This is big, beyond, way beyond just women's rights at this point.
That's very, very true. I mean, to be clear, this is a social movement first and foremost, but there are so many broader concerns being articulated here.
All right. Now, without further ado, let's hear from that very brave protester you spoke to.
Before we go into these interviews, a quick note. In Iran, wearing a hijab doesn't just mean wearing a headscarf. In addition to a scarf, Iranian women must wear loose clothing that doesn't emphasize their body shape and covers their legs and arms. A popular way of achieving that is to wear something called a manteau, from the French word meaning coat. It's a jacket or tunic that goes down to the mid-thigh. But sometimes women wear a more conservative garment called a chador, which is a big piece of fabric that covers the whole body. It's often all black, and it stretches down to the feet and wraps around the head. You're about to hear from a woman who will mention needing to wear the chador on certain occasions. This is a 37-year-old woman who's been participating in the protests in the northeastern city of Mashhad. She asked to remain anonymous for safety reasons. She shared with us some voice messages that she sent her family describing events she witnessed on September 19th, when protests were really beginning to erupt there. She actually stumbled upon a demonstration and its chaotic crackdown. She'd just been walking down the street and talking on the phone.
Suddenly, I saw that everyone was running. There were gunshots and anti-riot motorcycle riders. I shut my phone and just started running with the others. Everyone spread out into side alleys. People were telling each other, don't take this route, don't take that route. There were a lot of people. Girls had taken off their scarves and covered their faces with them to avoid being identified. It was obvious that all of them were young, mid-20s. They were very brave. It was thrilling. Suddenly, the police were attacking, hitting people. People were throwing stones, big chunks of stone, toward the police. There was a difference. When the people threw the stones, it would hit the police's shields and helmets. But when they threw the stones, it would hit people's heads.
She and others tried to flee.
Everyone was caring for each other, grabbing each other's hands and pulling them to make sure no one was left behind to the police. The stupid police, they had thrown a stone at an old woman. She was losing consciousness. It was frightening as well. At the same time, some motorcyclists were going back and forth with the news. The police are coming. Run away.
They took shelter for a while inside nearby shops.
The store doors would open and everyone, boys, girls, threw themselves inside and immediately closed the doors again. The police would come and shout in the street. We don't want to see a soul in the street.
But after a few minutes, a protester would give the signal for everyone to venture out.
The doors would open again, and from each store, 20 to 30 people would come out. The girls were extremely brave. They were screaming very loudly. They were all prepared, wearing masks and covering their faces. But I stood out from them with my bright-colored manteau. I held my friend's hand and told him, "We're already here, let's keep going." I was screaming, yelling, "Death to the dictator!"
The police were using tear gas, and she got hit multiple times.
I learned that tear gas burns your eyes a lot and makes your vision blurry, so much so that I was holding my friend's hand because I couldn't see him. And everyone started smoking because cigarette smoke nullifies the tear gas effect. If there were 100 people standing, 70 of them would be smoking. Everyone was smoking into each other's eyes. They'd breathe out and cup their mouths so that the smoke would go directly into the eyes. The eyes still burned the same amount, but at least we could see what was in front of us.
Eventually, her husband came on a motorcycle to pick her up and take her home to safety, but she repeatedly returned to the protests on subsequent days. I interviewed her less than a week later. It was difficult to get a hold of her. The Iranian government has been recurrently shutting down the internet and blocking access to many communications apps. Our connection was in and out, but I managed to ask her a few questions with translation help from her cousin. We used a VPN, and there was considerable noise on the line. Can she tell me why is she protesting?
We want to have the right to wear anything we want. We don't want to have this so much injustice in our government. We want men and women to have equal rights. But in the Islamic Republic, it's not like that.
What has it been like for you as a woman living in Iran?
She says that I am a photographer, and even though I have the official document for being a photographer, I am not allowed to enter many places to take photos because I am a woman. Like old marketplaces, they don't allow them to take pictures. And she also said that some places, when they go, they even take their cameras away from them. General events, mostly national events, like religious events or New Year's events and stuff like that, like they don't allow women to take pictures. And when they do, if they want to turn their photos in, like to be published or something, they have to wear a full like hijab, you know, like the, that you are covered in the black. Yeah, there are different levels to hijab. It's like the most extreme level one.
If she had a choice, would she wear a hijab?
Absolutely no. Many times the weather is hot and they are forced to wear a lot of clothes and layers like scarves. And it's very difficult. And in the meantime, it doesn't feel like she's looking good in them. You know, she says, I have two kids. And when I take them out, like crossing the streets or something, and I'm carrying some stuff as well with hijab, it is very difficult to manage the situation. And that's why if she had a choice, she would absolutely not wear the hijab and just wear something she's comfortable with.
Got it. So she lives in Mashhad, which happens to be the city where the 2018 protest wave started. So I'm assuming she saw those demonstrations as well. And I'd love to know how what's happening right now feels different from the 2018 protests or maybe other protests in the past.
She says, like, this time it is much more serious and more severe. And the people are actually gathering in more numbers each day that passes. Last time in Mashhad, it wasn't many people and it was something short. But this time it's taking long and people are keeping to the streets.
What does she think the outcome will be this time?
She's saying that even if we cannot diminish the Islamic Republic, we would at least get the mandatory hijab law taken away, and this would be the first step.
Why does she feel these protests are happening now?
She thinks that, and I agree with her, by the way, that people were just waiting for something to ignite, and they were waiting for a chance to take to the streets.
After that question, her call dropped, but her cousin and I got to chat for a few more minutes. I told him I was noticing that when he was criticizing the government, he was careful to use the term Islamic Republic rather than Iran.
Yeah. I used to talk about it in the sense that, like, it's just our government that we don't like anymore or we don't agree with anymore, but, like, especially after this protest, I think the situation has turned over some Islamic Republic that have taken Iran as their hostage. That is more like it, yeah. Because when you have very, very few people and using extreme violence to keep, like, I don't know, like 95% of the population, you know, that's not a bad government anymore. That's just a hostage. Keep it. Yeah, hostage situation. It is absolutely clear that it is Islamic Republic versus Iran. That is absolutely clear. What is actually keeping this regime in place is only that people have no replacement for them.
Later, in follow-up messages, he was still searching for the right metaphor. He said he thought prisoner might be better than hostage. And then he wrote, "What would you call a pack of vultures that have been picking on your body for the last 45 years? We are at the bones and feel like we have nothing left to lose." Clearly, the Iranian people are committed to fighting for a better system. And while it would be irresponsible to try to completely predict the outcome, we do want to discuss some of the possibilities and which seem more or less likely at this point. So to discuss just that, we've brought in Cornelius Adebar, non-resident fellow at Carnegie Europe. Cornelius, welcome to Asia Stream.
Thank you for inviting me.
So Cornelius, a lot of people are looking at the situation going on in Iran right now and thinking, why couldn't this end any differently from 1979, when there was a successful people-led revolution that overthrew the corrupt regime? In your opinion, is that actually a possibility here?
Well, it definitely is a possibility, but we have to be careful with those comparisons. I mean, 1978, 1979, first of all, it was a bloody revolution. It's not yet what we're seeing in Iran these days. And it was a revolution which was led from outside the country. Ayatollah Khomeini, he was in exile, and he had support structures inside the country, the mosques, the clerics, etc. So this is not comparable to what we can see today. Unfortunately, the situation today is more comparable to protests we have seen over the past years, recurring protests, which have been as recurringly put down by the regime with violent force.
Could you explain a little bit more? I mean, what is lacking here that would need to change in order for it to become something that could actually threaten the power of the government?
Well, it's already quite remarkable is the persistence we see among the demonstrators, the women taking the leadership, making this like a really fundamental issue. Because, as we know, the disadvantages of women, the repression of women is part and parcel of what the Islamic Republic is about. So this is not a protest which is only about some material stuff, work, the economy, even the environment. These are topics we've seen in the past. So that's the good part. What is lacking so far is that there is no structure behind this. There is no unifying organization, or I mean, I'm not going to say a leader that could run this as more of an organized protest. And it is not yet about an ideology beyond death to the dictator. So what unites people on the streets now is that they don't want the Islamic Republic, but they have no agreement whatsoever on what they would want in its place.
And in a piece that you just wrote for Carnegie, you contrast that with the mass protests in 2009. So could you explain how these are different?
Well, in 2009, what is commonly referred to as the Green Movement, the Green Revolt, this was political in the sense that it was about an election that had just taken place that many people thought was fraudulent, and that their candidate had lost. So millions took to the streets because they wanted their candidate to become president. This was what it was about. But it was within the system. So it was a different president within the system. And it was, to an extent, it was tolerated as an expression of disagreement. Also because the protesters did not question the fundamentals of the Islamic Republic. So this is very different what we have today. People are questioning the very basic tenets and the supreme leader. So they're really going against the system, and they are not tied to any of the political parties or the factions that we have at the moment, like the reformist movement or anything. This is really bottom up. This is people taking to the streets and voicing their anger.
If a leader were to emerge who could possibly guide this towards a transition of power, how do you think that would happen? And do you see any contenders?
Well, contenders I don't see for the moment. And again, comparing to the Islamic Revolution of 1979, I would guess that the leader would have to come from inside the country. Again, that's just different. There are, you know, people, prominent Iranians outside the country, but none of them seems to have a hold on the people or has the support inside the country. So what would have to emerge is a person that has some standing, has already had some standing over the past 40 years, but which isn't tainted, who isn't tainted by the Islamic Republic system, certainly not tainted by the crackdown, the current crackdown of the protest. And that's hard to see. I mean, could this be a business person, a cleric? Not so much. The dominant personalities, like a singer, certainly not, an artist. You can run through these lists and you don't really find a person, a single person that seems to be in this position right now. So I would assume this: there has to be a movement forming first. And this is where we run into problems. I mean, how can you sustain the protests on the one hand while building a movement where there isn't one? That's what really is the challenge.
Right. I mean, I think that's the question that everybody's wondering right now is how long are these going to last? Do they show any signs of tapering off at this point, or are they still just going strong?
They are going quite strong. I mean, we have to consider that we don't always know what is going on in the country. We're only getting some pictures, some impressions. But from what we can see, they are going on at a steady pace, I would say. Sometimes you hear about different groups joining the protests, like business people shutting down their shops, maybe some oil workers going going on strike. This would be a major shift if you had really, if you see parts of the economy siding with the protesters, or even, but this was just, you know, individual glimpses where security personnel also joined protests. So these are the signs that people are watching for. But for the moment, there is no real change visible, neither going much stronger or tapering off.
Those are exactly the things I was just about to ask you about. Yes, the strikes at the oil refineries, these images of riot police joining the protesters. I mean, I guess the problem with those is that those actions aren't happening in a great enough volume yet to move the needle. But are we close, or would you need to see them, you know, multiply exponentially in order to make a difference?
You would have to see like large parts of the business people or of the security service, like entire groups, the police, the internal security services, the army, the higher echelons. They would have to say, we are not going to shoot our own people. This is basically what happened in 1978, 1979, when the army said to the Shah, we are not shooting at our own people. Again, this is not what we can see today. To the contrary, what we can hear is that the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, which is this elite protective organization to protect the revolution, they are said to be infiltrating the police, the military, just to make sure that they don't waver. We are far from seeing like major movements on this side.
And what about any wavering within the Revolutionary Guard itself? Is that possible or out of the question, given how closely they're tied to the government?
Well, that's an interesting question, because what they might end up doing is to shed this Islamic part, the ideological part, and declare themselves to be the saviors of the nation, because this is ultimately a concern that most people have is, you know, where will Iran go if these protests continue, if the violent crackdown continues? So because the Revolutionary Guards, they are the strongest military organization, but they also have business interests, I mean, tangible business interests, infrastructure. They could be the ones saying, we are here to save the nation from falling apart. We will make those concessions on the part of religion and of ideology. But in the interests of the Iranian nation, we will take over. And then we end up with a nationalist militarist, authoritarian system, which is not what demonstrators are calling for these days. And whether it's slightly better of what we have today remains to be seen. But that is where I could see a shift coming out of precisely this elite organization.
Let's move on to the ethnic dimensions of what's happening. So obviously, Mahsa Amini was Kurdish, and some of the most violent protests are currently happening in the Kurdish regions of Iran. And so I guess there are a couple of different ways that you could look at this. In one sense, these protests are really transcending ethnic lines. Even though there's more violence in the Balochistan area, people across the country from all walks of life and all ethnic groups are joining the demonstrations. So that's maybe encouraging for people who are rooting for the protesters to have their demands met. But on the other hand, there are all these pre-existing ethnic divisions in Iran, and could this actually serve to exacerbate those or possibly even fuel the separatist movement? What do you see happening here?
Well, to a large extent, it will depend on what you describe as the way the protesters see themselves. I mean, whether they can maintain this inclusive momentum coming from the death of a Kurdish young woman, but extending to all walks of life, whether those who live in the peripheral regions, one has to say, the Kurdish region, the Arab region, but also the Baluchi region in the country's east, whether they can basically keep their own more separatist-minded people and possibly also more violence-prone people, whether they can keep them from joining or from overtaking, I would say, the protest. So it really comes down to whether those who are protesting, as little organized as they are, but whether they have in their own communities, whether they can maintain this basic idea of, we want a different political system, but we don't want the country from falling apart. That's a big challenge.
Cornelius Adebar, thank you so much for coming on Asia Stream.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, the international community is looking for ways to support the protesters, to discuss what should be done, and to explain how discrimination is embedded in Iran's laws. We are joined now by human rights lawyer Gisu Nia. She is director of the Strategic Litigation Project at the Atlantic Council and board chair of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center. Gisu, thank you so much for joining Asia Stream.
Thanks for having me.
So here's a recent tweet of yours. I'm just going to read it off. This isn't just about getting rid of the morality police. The entire legal discriminatory framework in Iran needs to go. Can you explain to us how discrimination is written into Iran's laws?
Absolutely. So the discriminatory legal framework in Iran does not only apply to gender. It does not only discriminate against women. It also discriminates against ethnic minorities, religious minorities, LGBTQ populations. Under the Islamic Penal Code, there are pretty harsh punishments for basically same-sex couplings. For women, you get lashes. For men, you can be killed. So execution is written into the code, and that's all there, and that's part of the law. Now, there are some commentators who would say, well, you know, sometimes it's not applied as much or something like that, but that's absolutely not true. They are applied, and there's something called like so-called morality crimes. And that's all written in the Islamic Penal Code as well. And maybe to nobody's surprise, those morality crimes are most harshly enforced when it comes to women. And so adultery, for instance, is a crime for which you can be stoned. In terms of ethnic and religious minorities, there's discrimination written into the law because ethnic minorities, for example, are not necessarily allowed to speak the language of their choice. And one thing about, you know, the protests that we're seeing over Mahsa Jina Amini's death, her actual name is Jina. That's a Kurdish name. And she wasn't allowed, you know, her family wasn't allowed to list that on her birth certificate. So that's why we know her as Mahsa Amini, but her real name and the name that her family called her is Jina. And so that's just another example of how ethnic minorities can't, you know, exercise the rights that they're guaranteed under international conventions. And for religious minorities, one key thing is that if you decide, you know, if you convert to another religion, so if you're born as a Muslim, if you convert to Christianity or any other religion, you're viewed as an apostate, and that also carries a sentence of execution. So these laws are actually enshrined in the legal framework in the Islamic Republic. It's all there for anybody who wants to see. And this is why there is a very comprehensive discriminatory framework that needs to go.
How likely is the potential for reform? Khamenei has been here since 89. It seems like discriminatory policies against women are only being more strictly enforced under Ebrahim Raisi. So is there a scenario in which the government decides to loosen its grip a bit in response to the protests? Or is reform not even possible under the government of people like Khamenei and Raisi?
I think it's really important to know that Khamenei is reportedly in ill health. So there's been conflicting reports about, you know, how close he is to death or not. There was a New York Times article stating that, you know, he was about to die, but then he was trotted out for Friday prayer. So a bit unclear, but we know that he's in ill health. So, you know, he's not going to be around. I mean, he's 83 years old. He's not going to be around forever. If there is a succession challenge, it will be interesting to see, you know, what kind of tensions that could bring to the surface. But I think there is a real role, like what we can do, you know, the Iranian people are going to decide, the people of Iran are going to decide what happens to them and what their future holds. But there are ways that the international community can support, and especially not to get in the way of the protesters. So, you know, there's been recurring protests in the country. Protests began in the aftermath of the disputed presidential election of June 2009. I think a lot of countries made really wrong choices at the time in terms of how they would support and how they didn't support, frankly. Since then, we see that there were nationwide protests in December 2017, January 2018. And then since then, there's been recurring protests with shortening spaces in between each, you know, fresh bout of protests. Sometimes those protests are about water shortages. Sometimes they're labor union strikes. There's been different reasons, but this spate of protests was clearly sparked by a demand for social change. And so there are no commentators that can discount it as something just purely due to economic concerns or something like that. That's absolutely not the case. And they're really calling for a revision of the system. So I think what the international community should be doing is making sure that they stand on the side of the people of Iran, that they ensure that they have internet freedom, that they ensure that those Iran regime officials, mid to lower level officials who may seek to flee the country in the coming months if they sense, you know, a bit uncertainty over their futures, to ensure that they can't store their assets offshore, that they can't just flee to properties in Switzerland or whatnot.
So you mentioned 2009. From your perspective, what did the international community do wrong in 2009?
Back in 2009, I think there were countries that were hesitant to show strong solidarity with the protesters. I think there was some bad advice that was given that essentially said that, you know, there's a long history of foreign interference in Iran's internal affairs. And so it's best if countries kind of, you know, don't say much and just let the Iranian people figure it out. And that's just absolutely not the right approach. Especially now when we live in such an intensely globalized world where we're all connected through the online web. I mean, Iranians are very connected online. And so the idea that somehow, you know, anything is just stays within borders is also just not, it's not really reflective of reality, particularly in the present day. So global solidarity and ensuring that the voices of dissidents, ensuring that the voices of those seeking human rights and freedom is amplified is not interfering. That's just, you know, human connection and essentially showing solidarity. So I think, you know, countries have gotten better on this. There's a increasing understanding that, you know, a safe and secure future really thrives on human rights being respected in countries.
Well, before I let you go, I just want to actually go backwards for a moment and kind of hone in on a point that you were making earlier. We were talking about what the international community can do and identifying two broad buckets. One was in terms of the free and open web, and then one was how to hold people who are low-level regime members who might be fleeing accountable and maybe preventing them from holding their assets offshore. So can we just get a little bit more specific with both of those things? What are concrete actions that could be taken, and where should they be taken?
So during the November 2019 protests in Iran, the Iranian state shut the internet down for 10 days and up to 2 weeks in some provinces in the country. And they killed up to 1,500 people under a cover of online darkness, essentially. So that was a real warning shot of what could come ahead. The Iranian state has been trying for years now to push Iranian users onto an intranet, so that they're cut off from the global worldwide web. And the parliament has passed various bills enforcing that. And so this has all been a concern, because if we're cut off from users inside the country, we won't be able to get the kind of information that we do get currently about violations. We won't be able to push for, you know, the kind of engagement and the policies and the kind of reform that they want to see inside the country. So that's why it was a big priority. Now, unfortunately, we're seeing that the internet is being cut off again during these current protests. Internet is slowing down to a crawl in some areas, and the volume of videos that we were getting in the very early days of the protests has now slowed to a trickle. There's different things that the international community can do. You know, this issue is not only one that's relegated to Iran. This has happened in Kashmir. This has happened in multiple countries and, you know, conflict areas or areas where there's some kind of heightened political sensitivity. And the international community needs to get really serious about dealing with what happens when a state just shuts off internet to its people. The UN has declared in the past that internet is a human right, actually. So there are the short-term solves of like how to patch internet in so that, you know, protesters can continue to have access to the outside world. But there's also like the longer term strategy about why this should be elevated to a priority, what needs to change, and so on. When it comes to accountability measures, there's a few buckets that states will need to look at. One is around how targeted sanctions. So essentially, you know, not these broad-based economic sanctions, but targeted sanctions, which really seek to surgically go after human rights violators and perpetrators of atrocity crimes who tend to be Iran regime officials and tend to be the ones that have the means to store their assets offshore. So while, you know, the people in Iran were dealing with crippling inflation and all that, a lot of the elites are just fine. They're profiting off the black market, and they also move their assets offshore. And you'd be surprised that their assets are in Canada. They are across Europe. So even though, you know, there's a lot of tough talk and there's a lot of discussion around targeted sanctions and not letting, you know, this kind of blood money enter these jurisdictions, it's absolutely not the case. I personally have access to multiple files of people that are responsible for human rights violations that we've looked up who own property in the UK, who own property in the US, who own property in Canada. Countries need to get serious about ensuring that that money can not only be frozen through targeted sanctions, but also seized and repurposed to rehabilitate victims and survivors of those regime official crimes. This is something that's being discussed with respect to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Probably some listeners have seen that, you know, in very flashy moves of government seizing yachts of oligarchs and things like that. The thing is, those were all like great, like theater, if you will, but the money from those yachts has not yet gone to Ukraine's reconstruction, because there's actually a very intense legal process that needs to happen. That's personal property. It has to be linked back to the human rights violating state in order to properly come under that jurisdiction. But there are efforts underway, different legislative proposals. The last thing I'll say is that I do think the United Nations needs to set up this investigative mechanism. And so the task would basically be to ensure that the collection of evidence about abuses that the Islamic Republic is committing against its people are properly collected in a way that can be admissible in court proceedings. That could happen in national jurisdictions across the world that have universal jurisdiction laws. What that means is there doesn't have to be any territorial or nationality link for a country to be able to prosecute an Iran regime official for crimes. If it's crimes against humanity, war crimes, torture, you know, certain crimes that are so heinous that those courts have decided that they should be allowed to try it, regardless of where they occur and who perpetrates them. The alternative is that there are options to do this through international courts, some of which, you know, lawyers have been creatively working on. And then also we shouldn't discount that maybe one day in Iran, there would be the possibility to have trials domestically, depending on what happens in the country. Right now, the judiciary is not independent. It's run, it's essentially controlled by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and its intelligence apparatus. And they're among the worst abusers of human rights, both inside Iran and abroad. But maybe one day, and maybe one day soon, there'll be an ability to actually prosecute offenders in Iran itself. And so any investigative mechanism that's set up could help support that function.
Gisunia, thank you so much for coming on Asia Stream.
Thank you.
That's it for Asia Stream this week. As always, I encourage you to head to Nikkei Asia at asia.nikkei.com for in-depth coverage of all things related to Asia. If you enjoy this podcast, please share, subscribe, and leave us a review and hopefully a 5-star rating. And a last reminder that Nikkei Asia is currently offering an exclusive discount for our podcast listeners. To get the discount, click the link in the episode description. Don't be lazy, just click it. This episode was produced by Monica Hunter-Hart. I'm your host, Waj Khan. We'll stream again next week for an episode on the Chinese Communist Party's 20th National Congress, where Xi Jinping is set to be effectively coronated into an unprecedented third term. Sure, he could be president for life, but you know what he doesn't have? Unlike Asia Stream, his own stream song.